Okay, welcome back. Hour number two. I'm glad you're along tonight. Good week underway already. Tomorrow, the big primary day, we'll have results for you tomorrow night. Commentary by Joel Skousen, as we have been having with Joel all through the season. Hour two tonight, we're going to talk to Herbert Dorsey again. A lot of email from folks about Herbert Dorsey, who is one of the most well-read and knowledgeable people on the eclectic, esoteric side of life and what's really going on than you'll ever want to hear. He's coming to us from the islands out there in the Pacific. Hello, Herbert. Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for being here again.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Good. Now, you have, of course, as we have mentioned, a number of fascinating books. And if you just click on Herbert's name or look below it, you'll find out what we're talking about. The Secret History of the New World Order, Secret Science and the Secret Space Program, and on and on. We've talked about a number of subjects. Tonight we're going to talk about very, very advanced, we could call it black ops, I guess, scientific achievements and science. And by the way, Herbert's newest book, The Covert Colonization of Our Solar System, is a must-read. They all are. So tell us what we're going to survey tonight. Now let's jump in.
Okay, well, I remember last time we had a talk, we were talking about free energy and how Dennis Lee was able to generate electricity from
in Ventura.
The air.
Yeah.
Right. And so I wanted to take that concept a little further. You know, we're talking about it, you know, air molecules at that standard temperature and pressure are moving about 700 miles an hour, and so that's a lot of kinetic energy there. But because it's random, there's no 700 mile an hour wind blowing.
Mm-hmm.
But you can cap this energy with because it creates temperature and pressure, and Dennis Lee successfully did that. Well, if we take that concept and reconsider the idea that ether actually does exist and empty space really isn't empty. The average ether molecule or particle is much smaller than a molecule. It'd be a very small particle, but it's moving.
Are they subatomic?
Oh, most definitely. Much smaller than an electron, even.
I just want to get that clear for folks. So there are in space, it's not empty. Space, no. According to Herbert's research, is full of energy, items, smaller than an atom, smaller, he suggests, than an electron. That's the ether. Go ahead.
Okay, so the average ether velocity, instead of 700 miles an hour, it's 3 times 10 to the 8 meters a second.
That's all, huh?
Astronomical. That's the speed of light. Okay.
Wow.
So anyway, if there was some way to tap the energy of the ether, it would be far more energy available than what's in the air at standard pressure and temperature.
Uh-huh.
So the problem is that ether goes through all matter. You can't contain it. You can't compress it. You know, it goes right through steel like it wasn't even there. It's so small that it goes right through any kind of matter. So
right.
How do you contain the ether? Well, Nikola Tesla suspected and experimented around that you can actually do it electromagnetically. That's the way you get a hold on the ether and try to use it for your own purposes. Okay, so one of the things I also talked about, he was using pulsating direct current instead of alternating current in his more in his later experiments. And when he pulsated this very high voltage, maybe 10,000 volts, and he pulsated it by using a rotating switch that would interrupt and go on and off, and he could do it like at 10 kilocycles around that area, he found out that if he sent this kind of direct current, pulsating direct current down a wire, that there was all kind of interesting phenomena that went with it. And he deduced that what he was doing was creating an ether wind. And so he did special kind of coils using this pulsating DC, and some of them were conical shaped and some of them were pancake coils. And he was able to actually magnify energy using these things.
Huh.
A lot of engineers would be very skeptical of that statement because they've been taught that you can't magnify energy. This thing called the conservation of energy, right?
So, Herbert, let me ask a question. Was Tesla able to influence the direction of the etheric particles or just the mass and its random chaotic flow?
No, he was actually able to make the ether flow in a specific direction. Usually it was down a wire. The wire acted like a channel, but the actual energy wasn't in the wire. It was around the outside of the wire.
Ah, wow.
But the wire would direct the flow.
Okay.
And it was almost like a fluid flow, according to his own experiments. A really good book for people who want to learn about this is by Gary Velasatos. It's called Lost Science, is one of his books.
Yeah.
And the other one is called The Secret Weapons of the Cold War. And anyway, so that's where you learn a lot of details about that. So I'm not going to get into it real in-depth.
Oh, Velasatos is a very underrated writer who was, I guess, kind of at his apex 20 years ago. People knew him more then. They don't know him much now anymore.
Well, the truth is ageless. It doesn't matter when it was
compressed. Oh, absolutely.
What matters is that it is brought up.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the conservation of the thermodynamic second law, which says that energy is conserved. And most people use that to debunk any claims of free energy machines. Well, a rule is true as long as you have a totally isolated system. The only problem is, as Thomas Bearden and many others have pointed out, is there is no such thing as a totally isolated system. Usually, there's all kinds of magnetic electric fields and other types of fields, gravitational fields, that penetrate the object. And one really big source of energy is the flux of neutrinos. The neutrinos at the surface of the Earth are 66 billion neutrinos per second per square centimeter. So there's a lot of neutrino energy flowing through, and they penetrate everything, steel walls, cylinders, anything like that. They're going through it all. And so if somebody could figure out a way to tap the neutrino energy, they'd have a heck of a source of energy.
Yeah.
So anyway, there was one professor who claimed to have done that. His name was Dr. Konstantin Mile. He's located in Europe, and he's written a number of books in German, but you can also get some translated into English. So if you just put that, Dr. Konstantin Mile into a Google search engine, you'll find his websites and information about his theories.
Okay.
His primary theory was the potential vortex. And he says this solves a lot of the problems at the atomic level and unifies and creates a lot more coherent theory of how atomic matter works and everything. But anyway, he said that in his flat pancake coils, similar to what Tesla was using, the neutrinos become unwound and turn into electrons and become current carriers. And he was able to magnify energy, and he even sells little kits. He's a professor. He teaches his theories to all his students, and they do experiments. And he's proven that, yeah, you get more energy out than you put in with these kits that he has. So he's well worth checking out on the Internet. But anyway, some of the other issues I wanted to get into. Electromagnetism, well, maybe I start with more simple stuff.
Well, I like the idea of what you did already was explaining the ether, that these are everywhere, apparently, in the universe. Wherever there seems to be space, there really isn't.
Right.
It's a venue for lots of particulate activity, but these particulates are subatomic, and even you're suggesting sub-electron in size. What would you call these etheric particles? Does anyone name them? You just call it ether and.
Let me point out a few things. Now, quantum physicists have developed a fairly good theory using quantum mechanics, and there's three things that he came up with. It's called the Planck length, which is the smallest quanta of length. And there's the Planck time, which is the smallest quantum of time. And then there's another thing called the Planck mass, which is the smallest quantum of mass. I cannot prove it, but I'm suggesting that these etheric particles may be the amount of mass of the Planck mass, which would be extremely small. Okay. I mean, that's just my own suggestion. I can't really prove it at this point. But anyway, so there are, space is real grainy. It's not continuous. It's quantized. This is what the quantum physicists have come up with. But anyway, getting back to some other ideas for people who have a little mechanical understanding, what if you took a pendulum and you put it on a seesaw? You got a pendulum that's on one side of a seesaw, and on the other side you have a piston. The seesaw is attached to a piston. Now, when you swing that pendulum back and forth, at the lowest part of the swing, it exerts a lot more force than it does at the upper part of the swing.
Okay.
Now, that's because it's the combined weight of the pendulum plus the centrifugal force of the pendulum. At the top part of the swing, the centrifugal force drops to zero because there's no velocity. So anyway, there's been an experimenter that did something like this. He swung the pendulum back and forth, and the other side of the seesaw is pumping up and down and running a water pump with it. Well, it turns out the amount of energy pumping the water is much greater than the amount of energy it takes to keep the pendulum swinging, because it's only limited by air resistance and maybe the fulcrum resistance. So there's a real simple mechanical gadget that can actually multiply energy. And it's been proven. The guy's done experiments. He's got his own website and all that. So I just wanted to show that it is possible with a real simple mechanical device to multiply energy.
Huh.
But now I want to get into electronics for some of the people who are more familiar with electromagnetics and all. We have three types of electromagnetic waves. In the engineering classes I was in, I was only taught about one of them. That's the transverse electromagnetic wave. But there's two other types of wave, and one of them is called the longitudinal wave. And the way you make longitudinal electromagnetic waves are using a special geometry of antennas. So with a flat plate antenna, all the electric vectors are radiating straight out from the plate. And in both directions, of course. So then when you oscillate this thing, the electric vectors are either going away from the plate or into the plate. There's no way that you can get a magnetic field out of the oscillating electric field, except on the borders of the plate, on the edges of the plate, you can get a small amount of magnetic field. So at that point, you have not an electromagnetic wave, you have an electrogravitic wave.
Mm-hmm.
It oscillates between the gravity field and the electric field,
right,
not between the electric field and the magnetic field. Okay? Now, a lot of people say, oh, how can you prove that, or how could that possibly be? And I will just say that in my last book, I developed a mathematical formula that shows that gravity, the gravitational potential, is merely the divergence of the electric potential vector, which is designated as A in your engineering books. The A vector, the quantum physicists have shown, is much more fundamental than the electric or the magnetic field. The vector potential, magnetic vector potential field, is used in quantum mechanics as the primordial field and the electric and magnetic fields are simply effects of the magnetic vector potential. So anyway, it's well known among electrical engineers that the E field is equal to the negative partial derivative of the A vector in respect to the partial derivative of the T vector. So that's how it turns out it's an electrogravitational wave instead of an electromagnetic wave. Another kind of antenna is a spherical antenna. All the E vectors are going radially away from the center of the sphere, and all the magnetic fields that would have been generated by the oscillating E fields are now canceling each other out. So it's even more efficient at eliminating the magnetic effects than the flat plate antenna. So here's how you generate longitudinal waves. Now, the interesting thing about longitudinal waves, they can penetrate conducting matter. So submarines under the ocean can use longitudinal waves to communicate with each other.
Okay.
Now I'm going to get into scalar waves. These are even more exotic.
Now here's an area that a lot of people say, well, everyone talks about scalar this and scalar that. Nobody really understands it. Nobody can prove it. It's not been proven.
It's pure.
I'm telling you what you hear out there, that it's purely speculative. This is the common criticism of it. So let's put for once and for all on the table the reality of this thing. Go ahead.
I won't be the first to put the reality on the table. I give the credit to Thomas Bearden.
Well, Tom, I know Tom for a long time, and I haven't been able to get him on the air because he just doesn't do radio.
Yeah, he's getting pretty old now.
Well, he even years ago he said, "Jeff, I just can't do it." He was warned. Yeah. All right, let's leave it at that. Yeah. He knew too much.
Oh, I got it. Okay. Well, I'm not afraid of him.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go and tell it like it is.
All right.
Okay, now, according to Thomas Bearden, and he's written a lot of good books about this stuff, and I'm a student of his.
Yeah.
Scalar waves are made by combining two regular electromagnetic waves 180 degrees out of phase. So in other words, in electrical engineering, if you brought these waves that were 180 degrees out of phase, which means the wavefronts are opposing each other, basically. One wave has the positive maximum, while the other wave has the negative maximum. That's 180 degrees out of phase. Well, in electrical engineering, they say, oh, those two waves cancel each other, and there's nothing left. Okay, that's standard theory. Thomas Bearden says, no, wait a minute. There's a pressure wave. It's just like if you got two elephants pushing against each other.
Right.
There's a pressure between them. They don't cancel, their forces don't cancel out. And they're ignoring the pressure wave. Well, that's the scalar wave. Now, what's interesting about the scalar wave is that it doesn't have any extension in space. It only exists in the time axis. This is according to Thomas Bearden. Okay, now, so that means that since every instant of time in the whole universe is the same instant, that these scalar waves can be transmitted instantaneously, doesn't matter how far away the signal will arrive at the same instant that you transmit it. So they're instantaneous. That's the first exotic thing about scalar waves. The next interesting thing, and Thomas Bearden has suggested this, and other people have experimentally discovered this, that these scalar waves can affect time. They affect time itself. And I'm going to quote a time machine experiment done by Dr. Vadim Chernobrov. I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. He's a Russian scientist. And his experiment was described in New Energy Technologies magazine of the year 2001 in issue number 23, which can be obtained at faraday.ru. In this experiment, they were able to change the flow rate of time by about 3%. I studied that experiment very carefully, the technical setup and everything. And what they were doing, they had these concentric, the fiberglass spheres, three of them, and then in the center they had an area where you could put your test objects or human beings. They made a big enough one to put humans inside. And with these spheres, they had all these electromagnetic solenoids, so all of them were aimed towards the center of the sphere, which was the test area. And they were pulsing these electromagnetic solenoids with pulse waves. And so I thought about it, and with that kind of a geometry, all these waves arrive at the center, but they all cancel each other out because they're all coming in regularly from every direction into the center. So what they were doing is, in effect, creating scalar waves at the center of the experiment. Now, it's not it didn't get really sensational because they were only able to change the flow rate of time by about 3%. But there were interesting effects that happened while they were changing the flow rate of time. And anybody who wants to know about it needs to get a hold of that issue of that magazine, which is obtainable at www.faraday.ru.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anyway, they were able to change the rate of flow of time. They experimentally proved it could be done, and they did it with using scalar waves. Okay, so another scientist thought, oh, this is pretty exciting. His name was Albert Vianek, and he's from Belarus. And so what he did, he took a flywheel. And we all
can
know
we, Herbert, can we hold that thought right there? We got to do a little pause here. We got flywheel, so we'll come right back and pick it up right there with Herbert Dorsey. Fascinating conversation. In just a few minutes, hold on, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Okay, welcome back, talking to Herbert Dorsey. Okay, Herbert, let's pick it up right there, if you can.
Okay, I was just talking about how the rate of time can be changed using scalar waves.
Right.
And I mentioned the experiment where it happened and how you can find out more about it. Well, anyway, this fellow named Albert Vianek said, well, that's interesting. I'm going to try an experiment with a flywheel. So he took a flywheel and he put some scalar wave generators, which were just solenoids aimed at each other, which would cancel out the magnetic fields and create scalar fields.
Right.
And on each side of the flywheel. And on one side, he created a positive time flow, or increase, made the time increase at the rate of flow, and the other side it decreased the rate of flow using these scalar waves of the right polarity. And so what happens, well, the centrifugal force on one half the flywheel was greater than on the other side.
Huh.
So the whole flywheel was generating a force in one direction, and I thought that was kind of an interesting experiment because it can be used out in space, propel rockets around, and to correct orbits and stuff like that.
Most interesting.
Okay, so now we get into artificial gravity. Now, Biefield-Brown effect is hardly ever taught about in any. I've never heard of it being taught about, in fact, in any university. The Biefield-Brown effect is actually created.
Did that have anything to do with T. Townsend?
Yes, T. Thompson Brown was the Brown part of it, and Byfield was his professor, and they experimented together, and they came up with the Byfield-Brown effect. Anyway, they were using capacitors, and they noticed that when they charged these capacitors, they had a high dielectric constant, and they had a high dielectric breakdown strength, and they would charge these capacitors up to 30 to 50,000 volts. And they discovered the capacitor would move towards the direction of the positive plate. That's the Byfield-Brown effect. Well, there's problems with that effect, because what happens is the dielectric becomes polarized inside. And once it gets polarized, the effect goes away. So it only lasts for maybe a few seconds, and then the dielectric is polarized, and, you know, they lose the effect. So Thompson Brown came up with a way to overcome that. He came up with several ways to overcome it. One, he had a bunch of sectors, and he would turn one sector of the capacitor off while he turned another one on, and allowed the relaxation time for the dielectric before he recharged it again. The other way he did it was using an air dielectric, which was nowhere near as effective as far as the force generated, but he still could generate a force, and the air would flow through the thing, and they didn't have to worry about the polarization effect. And so he developed these things, which you can find out if you put Byfield Brown in or T. Thompson Brown into a search engine. But anyway, they did a lot of experimenting at an observatory, and they found out that this artificial gravity effect definitely was affected by the different planetary alignments, and particularly the moon and the sun.
Oh, now so this you're getting close to astrology here.
Well, not only that, but it did show that it was gravitational and not due to some other effect.
Right.
Because the effects would vary with the planetary alignments.
Well, it's almost validating, in an offhanded way, astrology there. It's getting close.
The other thing was, the Navy became really interested in T. Thompson Brown, and he did a lot of different interesting experiments for the Navy, which I mentioned in my book. Nowadays, they have a hobby. A bunch of people are interested in these things called lifters. And you go to American Anti-Gravity or any of these other websites, you'll see all these hobbyists making lifters. They're using the Byfield-Brown effect in the air. And they're pretty easy to make, except for the high-voltage generator. Well, anyway, this fellow out in Russia came up with an even much better version of the dielectric lifters. His name was Alexander Frolov, and he had a really interesting website. It was called, this is the one I mentioned before, Faraday.ru.
Right.
And at the time, back in the early, around 2001, he had a new energy technologies magazine that he was publishing, and there was an English version which I subscribed to. And that's how I found out about all these time machines and stuff. But anyway, it was a fascinating series of magazines. And you can still get back issues if you go to Faraday.ru and order a CD that has all the magazines on a CD format. But anyway, he came up what he called Frolov's hat. And the way it worked is when you visualize two plates of a capacitor with maybe air dielectric in between. Well, we all know that if they're oppositely charged, they're going to attract each other. So you have to hold them apart from each other. Well, supposing you took those plates and you put them, they were oppositely charged, but they were on a flat plane, and between one plate you had a real high dielectric, so that the fields wouldn't short each other out. But anyway, I won't try to describe it over the phone, but if you look up, put Frolov, F-R-O-L-O-V, apostrophe S, hat, H-A-T, lifter, and do a Google search engine, you'll see how this marvelous device works. Mm. It's much more efficient than the other lifters were that all these hobbyists have been making and playing with. A couple of comments about that. One, it is truly an anti-gravity effect. It's not an ionic wind effect, because these things have been tested in vacuums, and they work even better in a vacuum than they do in the air. Okay?
Would space be called a vacuum in that sense, or are you talking about an ether-free vacuum?
There's no true vacuum, because if you consider ether...
Can't be with
really
ether.
No,
right.
Yeah. It's not a true vacuum, but there's no air molecules there, so it's like outer space.
All right.
Right. So that's what I mean by a vacuum. All these inventions and discoveries, what T. Townsend Brown had discovered, was back in the 1920s. I believe he had some patents as early as 24 on these devices.
He was one of our greatest geniuses, and nobody knows about him.
He was right up there with Tesla. He was a genius. And if you read my book, you'll find out all the stuff, interesting stuff he found out, and some little bit of the conspiracy of people that he worked with. And most interesting of all, and I know Alfred Beilik. You know who Alfred Beilik is?
I've had Al on the program years ago before he passed. Yeah, I do know Al.
Yeah.
I knew him.
Well, I knew him back in the 90s. I met with him about five different times. I was at a lot of conferences with him that he was giving. And I was even at one conference where I got to talk with him for about an hour because the conference was a failure. I mentioned that in my book, too. But anyway...
I remember that. You told us a little bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a survivor of the Philadelphia experiment, and very fascinating material in his talks. And I've been to five of them, and they were all identically the same, and nothing changed. And I had a lot of respect for him. He seemed like a college professor to me. He was quite a guy.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he mentioned that T. Townsend Brown was one of the guys that worked on the Philadelphia experiment. And I did a little background.
I've never heard that. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. He was one of the scientists working on it. And another one was Einstein. They had Einstein there. They originally had Tesla working on it, but he resigned from it because he was concerned about the effects it would have on human beings.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other guy was Joseph von Neumann. Was the other guy that worked on it that Al Beilik told me about. But anyway, what I'm saying is that a lot of this stuff happened a long time ago. They had already perfected teleportation, time travel. The Philadelphia experiment was probably one of the first teleportation experiments the Navy did. But they got all the bugs worked out of it. The first one was a horrible consequence of anybody who's read about the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, that's what Al said so many years ago on this program. And, yeah, it's written about.
But I just want to point out all this stuff was going on during World War II and after World War II. And all the stuff's been improved greatly since then. And as William Tompkins is now coming forward and talking about, they've generated a lot of technology that the Germans originally came up with for the flying saucer technology and anti-gravity. They even had their cigar-shaped motherships. The Germans developed those too. And as Tompkins is saying, they had spies checking up on the Germans, and they got wind of what they were up to, and they were starting their own programs into some of this anti-gravity technology and whatnot. And and plus, you know, we have all these people that were involved in the secret space program. They created a secret space program that didn't use rockets, used anti-gravity. And they kept it totally secret from the American public and the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now the secrets are starting to come out.
Yes, they are.
And Tompkins is a very good source.
He'll be back this Friday, by the way. He'll be back on this Friday.
Yes, I understand. And I would like maybe you could put a couple of questions to him. Now, when he's on the interview with you. See, there's all these guys, there's three guys that have come forward and said, yeah, I was involved in the secret space program. Their names were Michael Relf, Randy Kramer, and Corey Good. I'm sure you've heard of them.
Yeah.
And the thing that they had to put up with, each one of those men had to put up with agreeing to a 20 and back tour of duty. And, well, what does 20 and back mean? Well, it meant you signed up for 20 years of service. At the end of the service, your memories of the whole service were erased electromagnetically. And then you were put into an age regression chamber where you had to be held totally still for about 2 weeks. And they regressed you back 20 years of age, so you look 20 years younger. And then they sent you back in time, 20 years back in time, to when they originally drafted you into the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So now you don't have any memory of it, and you're starting all over again. And theoretically, it would seem like you never even did the 20 years of service. It was all over. That's what all three of these men have testified to in their different interviews with people like Michael Sala, who I'm a good friend with, and a lot of other people, too. I can't think of his name right now. Anyway, the one question I'd like you to put to Mr. Tompkins when you...
Well, by all means, email the questions as well, but go ahead and state them now. They're listening, so...
Okay, now, he is, through some of my correspondence with Frank Chile, who he's in contact with, he says that he got to talk with some of the people running these ships, and they were describing other planets that they had been on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like you to ask them if any of these crewmen on these ships have to do the 20 and back tour of duty and be subjected to all the stuff that Randy Kramer and Corey Good and
Okay,
the other thing is, he's in his book, he said he was designing naval spaceships that were 2 kilometers long.
Right.
I want to know where the heck were they actually building these ships.
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to pin them down and get an answer. I don't know, for maybe security reasons, he may not want to answer. But,
I don't know that he could answer that fully. He has basically suggested that naval dry dock areas were used to create these either in segments or in total, if they weren't necessarily 2 kilometers long. They were large. They looked like ships, but they were spaceships, and they were taken up from there. So that's one possible answer that he has already given. We'll ask him again.
Okay.
He also said they were built underground.
Yeah, okay. Well, they would have to keep them a secret.
They'd have to have a hell of a big door, though, wouldn't they? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay, one of the things he did suggest, that they were building, like, these nuclear submarines by taking all the nuclear stuff out of it and putting anti-gravity stuff into it.
Uh-huh.
The submarine makes a perfect spaceship because it's already, you know, it's got these hulls that are designed to stand tons of pressure on them.
Yeah.
So you could just go out to sea and then launch out into space with it.
That's an interesting idea. Yeah.
No, he actually brought that up in one of his interviews.
Yes, he did. Yeah. No, I remember.
Okay. So, anyway, those are issues I really definitely wanted to cover in this interview. But if we got more time, I could get into other stuff, too. I don't know.
We have about 7 minutes.
Okay. Really interesting thing is there are people making free energy machines that I'm aware of that actually do work, and I'll get into principle of one of them.
Do you see there were remember the Australian guys who had the electric? It was mostly magnetic, but it was a wheel or some kind of a went round and round, and they. On this program, must be 10 years ago now, they said these will be in Walmart and in Sears, and they were real close. And then they came up with some, they came up with some alleged calculation problems, and they had to go back to the drawing board. And I never understood really what happened, but I wasn't surprised at all that they didn't appear in the, in fact, I was promised the first one in the U.S., but I didn't hold my breath. I think they were very serious about it, but the two Australian guys.
Yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure I know who you're talking about. I just can't remember the name of their outfit.
Right.
But I do remember the name of one guy that was going around for a while. It was called Perendev, and he had an all-magnetic motor. It was just permanent magnets. That's all he powered it. And I actually saw videos of it running and stuff. But there was all kind of insider power plays going on and business deals that went awry.
But absolutely.
The technology worked. Although there's been people who said, well, maybe the magnets didn't last very long. Somehow the energy was being sucked out of the magnets.
That's not supposed to happen.
Right.
No.
Yeah. So I don't really buy that argument. If it's working, it's going to work. Especially if you have a... Basically what they had a wheel with a bunch of magnets in it set at a certain angle.
That's correct.
And there was really critical the angle, and they were actually, they had a slant cut on the face of the magnets. And this was all critical. And then they had an outer layer that could, like a C-clamp, it could come together and go right outside the other magnets or go apart and turn the machine off.
Uh-huh.
That's how they had a speed control on it. So they'd bring this outer clamshell thing together where it was just really close to the rotating magnets. And they were in the repulsion mode. And then suddenly the damn thing would start spinning like crazy. And they claimed they could tie a generator to it and power electricity out of it. Okay, but that one never got off the ground. But, I mean, 10 years ago, I think is when I first heard of it.
That's right. That's about exactly right, yeah.
So I don't know if it's a technical problem or a political problem. I suspect it's a political one.
I would think it would be all about money. I mean, you're challenging the whole petroleum chemical industry here, and you don't, they'll kill people. They're not going to allow themselves to be taken down or damaged. No way.
There's another guy named Johnson. He had a Johnson magnetic motor. It's very famous. It's patented. And it was in Mechanics Illustrated magazine. Had an article on it with a photograph of it, and it absolutely does work.
I remember the Australian guys. Their company was called Lutec, L-U-T-E-C,
That sounds about right.
There were two of them, and
I kept waiting for it to get on the market. I'll buy one if it does.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Another guy that's really interesting is this guy Keshe. I'm sure you've heard of the Keshe Foundation.
Keshe.
The Iranian nuclear scientist.
Yeah. Gordon Duff knows all about Keshe.
Yeah, I've been reading his articles. I get the Veterans Today.
Yeah.
I think they're an interesting source of info. I don't agree with everything, but I think, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, Keshe has an anti-gravity flying car department. They're trying to build a whole flying car.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some videos of a car that was flying. I don't know if it was a faked or what. I really don't know.
Well, Gordon will be on tomorrow night, and Keshe always pops up in the conversation, so we'll see what the latest is.
Okay, I even ordered some.
Whoops. He ordered some. Now we'll never know. We're going to call him back. Hopefully, if you're listening, hang up, Herbert, and we'll call you right back. That's what happens with those little tiny phones with the little tiny push buttons. You can bump them real easily. Some people, when they use them, they rub on their chin or their cheek, and that gets in the way, too. Yeah, the two fellows in Australia, Lutec, and very interesting. I remember they were on three times. The licensing of what was formerly Lutec is now, this is 2010, an update, I didn't know this, being handled by Evergreen Enterprise International Limited of Hong Kong. Hmm. So, yeah, there's a picture of the electricity amplifier, is what it was formerly called at one point. And I don't know what happened to the two inventors, if they left completely and sold the machine off or not. You back, Herbert?
Yep.
Okay.
I don't know what happened. We got cut off there for a second.
No, it's just people playing games, probably. Yeah, I was just looking up Lutech, and the two gentlemen apparently sold. This is an update in 2010, 6 years ago. The licensing of what was formerly Lutech Technology is now being handled by Evergreen Enterprise International of Hong Kong. You know what Evergreen is? It's a CIA company. I don't know if this one is, but Evergreen Air is CIA. So here's Evergreen again. Maybe they bought it up. They may have bought it up to, you know, hide it away. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I tell you,
go ahead.
There's more efficient machines out there, though. Don't worry about it.
Well, from talking to you, and Herbert and I went to the same alma mater, UC Santa Barbara. He got a degree in something worthwhile. I didn't, but anyway.
Oh,
actually, history was all right. I was a history geology major. Okay, now... thank you, Herbert. We'll talk again. Let me know when you're ready and you want to come back on, and I'll try and get those questions to Bill Tompkins on Friday. And so email me the questions and anything else that you may want to ask, and we'll get those asked about the 20 and back, and where were the big 2 kilometer long craft actually made? In one piece?
That's the big question.
And, and then the submarine portion, we'll see if we can revisit that as well.
Well,
all right.
Already talked about that.
Yeah. Well, it's still a good subject. Thank you very much, Herbert, and let me know, and we'll get you back.
Okay, I'm usually available. I'd love to talk.
Great. Well, you do a great job on it. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
All right. Good night. Herbert Dorsey. All right. There we go. Extremely wise and intelligent man in that field and many fields. We will be back with hour 3 and our weekly radiation update, Fukushima, on the biggest story of our times that is not being talked about, the death of the entire North Pacific Ocean and the radiation being spread all around the Northern Hemisphere 27 hours a day for 5 years. Back in a minute.